Welcome to Medroom Chronicles. Join nurses and other care providers as they let you in on discussions usually reserved for the privacy of the locked medication room. In this weekly nursing podcast, the filters come off and we tell it like it is. Your hosts, nurses Adrienne Benning and Andrew Craig, are here to educate and entertain on all things in the nursing world. This podcast is intended for nursing students, nurses, nursing assistants, and other care providers. Non-medical folk will probably get a kick out of us too. If you like what you hear, subscribe and share. Happy nursing, folks. Welcome to Medroom Chronicles, guys. This is Adrienne. I'm here with Andrew once again. Andrew, hey, how's it going?
It's going very good. It is 6:07 in the morning.
A.K.A. my 6 p.m.
Right. This is night for us, right? This is kind of like winding down normally, but right now I'm in Minnesota visiting family, friends, and normal people are on day shift, so I feel a little, you know, discombobulated.
Yeah, I was actually just, I was actually just texting with a couple nurses that are on shift right now. I'm sitting in my guest room, and I was trying to see if I could get an early breakfast crew together, but it sounds like some people have plans. A couple people wanted to go out to eat a little later in the morning, but for those of you that follow football, it's actually, what day is it? We're recording this on October 7th, and it's our homecoming weekend. So,
the University of Iowa's homecoming.
Yes, the University of Iowa, party school extraordinaire. So today is going to be a little bit of a shit show, and we've got some political things going on that I'm not going to get into, but so let's just say that it is 6 a.m. I guarantee that if I were to step outside my house and walk two blocks in any direction, that I would find bros on roofs drinking Bush Light or PBR. I guarantee it.
For those who don't know the anatomy of the area around the University of Iowa Hospital,
speak up a little bit, man.
It is a freaking nightmare. It is so bad.
It is.
I'll tell you, the deal is the stadium is like a stone's throw away from the hospital.
Yeah, like I could hit a golf ball from the roof of the hospital into the stadium.
Listen,
and I don't golf.
You could hit a croquet ball. You don't even need golf clubs to do it. It is so close, and on the nursing, on the healthcare provider, and on game day, you best believe you should show up to work like 2 hours early.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Which is nonsense because
and know where you're going to park because the ramp that you usually park in might be buried in a sea of drunk people, and you can't go there. So
there is one benefit. You know, when we were there, they had just broke ground on the Children's Hospital. And that's all done now, correct?
It is. And not only, I think they opened it in December or January. They had a couple delays, but it's now up and running. It's a beautiful, I mean, you can see it from quite a distance away. You can see it from like out on the west side of Coralville, which is our sister city. The new tradition that they've started, I don't know if folks have heard about this in the news, but or if you've heard about it even, but the top, I think, two or three floors of the Children's Hospital have a perfect bird's eye view of the entire stadium. So the new tradition is that I believe at the end of the first quarter of every home game, the entire stadium turns around and waves to the kids.
Oh, my God. That is so freaking awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, so and, awesome. You know, these kids are stuck in the hospital. You know, I don't work peds. I can't do it. I prefer my old crazy dementia patients that I love so much. But you know what? That's pretty cool. So even though I absolutely hate the fact that we have to have crazy security and people tailgate in the ramps, like, for example, if I were working tonight, this morning, I would be leaving work in about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And as I walk out to the ramp where I park every single shift, there's the same group of people that's always in the same spot outside the ramp that's like, you know, maybe 300 yards from the stadium, and they always have their grill out and they're always making bacon and pancakes. And so I hit the parking ramp and I get this mixture of like motor oil, car exhaust, bacon, and maple syrup. And so that combination to me is like the eau de toilette of Hawkeye football.
We should bottle it and sell it. Did you just hear that snap? That was a Starbucks iced coffee that opened up.
I think that sounds delicious.
We need to trademark that. The eau de toilette of Iowa. That's a pretty solid French there. My goodness, Adrienne.
Je suis désolé. And that is all I can say in French. I can also speak a little bit of German. I also hablo un poquito español. Ich spreche ein bisschen Deutsch, aber yo hablo español bastante bien que alemán. Okay, there you go.
Listen, for the people that are listening right now, I had no idea until this very moment that Adrienne has this talent. Just randomly spitting out Rosetta Stone on command.
You guys get Duolingo. I mean, I took Spanish in high school, and I took accelerated German with my boyfriend in college before I was to get into the nursing program that I'm in now. So yeah, I speak a little bit. I don't speak it very well. I can do like half of a neuro assessment in Spanish. Like I can say like mene sus dedos del pie, which means wiggle your toes.
That is so impressive, Adrienne.
Yeah, I can do basic things. I can be like, do you have to pee? Do you have pain? Do you want some juice?
I know pain. Is it tienes dolor?
Yes. Tienes is the cognitive. Well, anyway, we don't need to get into what am I trying to say? I'm not even using the right word because I'm tired. Conjugating. We don't need to conjugate verbs. But yeah, that's basically, do you have pain?
Gotcha. I had a patient when I was in long-term care that spoke all, fluent Spanish speaking. And, with dementia, that's about the only thing that she could communicate was pain. And you could tell with nonverbals at that point.
Speak up a little bit, Andrew. Guys, just for the record, we're Andrew, because he's traveling, we're on the fly. So he was awesome enough to go out and get a headset in the middle of the wee hours of the morning so that we could podcast for you. So bear with us.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's perfect. Can you hear me now? Okay. Yeah, that's perfect. But you were saying...
I was just saying that it just reminds me, the importance of having a little bit of that Duolingo business going on, because... I had a patient that spoke all Spanish, and when you're in long-term care, you have that same patient for months at a time, so you have to learn to adapt to
this
culture, and I think it's really awesome that not only do you know a little bit of, some significant assessment information to, make your patients feel a little more at home.
But, to clarify for our nurses who maybe don't live in areas that have a high level of... patients with different languages, or for students, you also have to be careful, because while I can do a basic assessment, I still will get a translator. Like, for example, I discharged a patient when I was still working days. I discharged a patient who spoke no English and she had no family present, but I was discharging her on warfarin, and I needed to do really solid education on that medication. Because for those of you that don't know, it's a blood thinner. So in addition to taking it properly, you need to be careful, because if you cut yourself or you fall down or you get punched or something like that happens, you're just going to bleed like it's your job. So for things like that, or for consent forms or anything like that, you still have to have someone who is legally able to translate for you. So that's my little public service announcement. It's great to use whatever language skills you have. It's great to use Google Translate. Is hit or miss in terms of being able to allow you to communicate with patients. But generally speaking, I can do basic, like, I'm your nurse. Do you need anything? Are you okay? Like, I at least can assess enough to know if they're saying, like, it feels like my head is on fire, I can figure that out and call the doctor.
Hey, do you guys have the blue phones still?
We do still have the blue phones. So we have one phone, and I haven't used it before, because on night shift, we do a lot of pantomiming and rely on family a lot, which is, we're lucky when family sticks around. But the Blue Phone, essentially, folks, is like a, it's literally blue. It has two handsets so that we can plug the phone in and the nurse can be on one handset, the patient can be on the other, and they call a translator who then acts as, you know, the problem is that they're translating medical information in a setting that they can't see. So they might be describing, the patient might have trouble describing something and the translator can't help because they can only repeat what the person is telling them. But it's sure great in a pinch when you have a patient who speaks a language that you don't even have a frame of reference for. Like, you know, if we have a patient that speaks like, I think we had a patient that speaks like Urdu, if I'm even saying that correctly. And
That's a Middle Eastern.
Yeah, and yeah. So,
I was gonna say, I was going to add to that. So at other places that I've traveled to, they have iPads that are essentially like Skype.
Which is great. I want that. There's so much technology.
Yep.
My partner, Doug, actually put something up on my Facebook page today about how Google is working on earbuds that will translate languages in real time. So you put these earbuds in and it essentially acts as a filter. Now, I think the technology is still in like the adolescent stages. And, you know, like I said, Google Translate still does do some funny things because I can kind of check it a little bit. Sometimes the Spanish translations are slightly off. Colloquialisms are hard, you know, medical information is hard. That would be really, really cool if we could just put in a set of earbuds or put them in the patient and, you know, say to the patient, you know, I need you to take these pills so you don't die. Or to even be able to say, like, you're safe, like you're in a hospital in a foreign country, but you're okay. Yes. We do have our talking beds, which I think we got after you had departed the university. But the beds that we have, among some of the other functions, like playing music and sound effects, you can get it to say certain phrases, pre-programmed phrases, in a large number of languages. Basically, the basics like, you're in the hospital, we're taking care of you, you're safe, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you know.
Holy, that is interesting.
That kind of thing.
Those beds are, you know what? Okay, so those beds are phenomenal.
Yeah, here, bring your microphone a little closer. Sorry.
You know, those beds are awesome. They do a lot of amazing stuff. But they are still uncomfortable to people. And I just don't understand. Like, we drop like 30, 40, 50 grand a bed, a single bed.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
And everybody's still in pain.
They're still in pain. They're not comfortable. It's like, whoever designs beds needs to get their shit together. Because uncomfortable.
And also, I think it's important to really have a bed that fits your patient population because, like, we're a step-down unit, so we're not ICU, so we don't get, like, the ICU beds that do, like, percussive therapy and rotational therapy. We only get those if they send them to us with a really high-risk patient that we don't want to move necessarily just yet. But for all intents and purposes, we're not ICU, but we're eking into critical care because we're taking vented patients. You know, we're taking patients that are on drips. Like there are certain drips that we even take in palliative care. But yeah, we have patients that are on drips and some of them are pretty specific. Even in palliative care, we sometimes take drips, but, you know, we're not necessarily titrating them like they do in the ICU. Sometimes they're excuse me, I have a tickle in my throat. Sometimes they're life prolonging meds. Other times they're just symptom management. But the point is that we have patients that are at high risk of pressure ulcers and respiratory, you know, they need pulmonary toileting on a real, sometimes more regular basis than we can get to them. So I really wish that we could have a stash of ICU beds, you know. But like everywhere else in healthcare, unless you're working for a really rich private hospital, you've got to make do with the resources you have. And the beds that we have are new and they're nice. But, you know, there are some things, even though they say these nurses or that these beds were designed with the input of nurses, there are some things that are on these beds that I'm like, no nurse would ever tell you to do that. Right. Like, for example, right. Our beds are wonderful beds that, you know, talk and play music and whatever. The controls to elevate the head of bed are not on the inside of the rails. They're on the outside of the rails, and then the patient gets a remote control. But the cord for the remote control is like, you know, the length of my pinky finger. I mean, I'm being, you know, this is a little hyperbole, but really the cords are so short that they end up on the floor, or the patient has the control for their bed at their knee. You know, it's like, yep. No nurse told you to put a remote control. Put it where the patient can see it, right in their face, on the rail, where it's not yep. going to fall. So anyway, that's a big yep. tangent. But how did we get here? What was the whole point?
I don't know, Adrian. I have no clue. We've gone in the deep end. I'm lost right now.
All right. Well, that was a nice little intro into the life of a night shift nurse at the end of their day.
No, it was cool. It's totally cool. I was very interested. I know what this means, but some people don't know what this means, Adrian. I was listening to what you're talking about, like CPT and pulmonary toileting. Now, some people, they don't necessarily know what pulmonary toileting means because it's not archaic, but some people just, you know, don't know what that word means. So you tell people.
Yeah. And also, you know, I'm still in my adolescent stage of pulmonary nursing. So please correct me if I go off the path here, but essentially, okay. So here's the first thing. If you have a lung infection or you have COPD or any kind of really lung injury or disease, one of the things that happens is you get these messed up secretions. What do I mean? All that mucus that we experience when we've had a cold. Well, some people have that mucus constantly or, you know, for the duration of their illness. And so, you know, some people can cough it up and spit it out, and other people that are more compromised, whether they have a tracheostomy or they just have, they're weak or whatever, all that mucus just sinks to the bottom of their lungs and it gets sticky and it's a breeding ground for bacteria. And so not only is it important for us to move people around in bed for, you know, relief of pressure so they don't get like bed sores and like wounds and stuff. But also we need to make sure that all of that sticky mucus and all these secretions and infection and whatnot isn't just like kind of solidifying into silly putty at the base and back of their lungs. And so pulmonary toileting quite literally are the things that we do to make sure that we're keeping the airways clear. You know, and so pulmonary toileting, correct me if I'm wrong, is a combination of factors. It's pounding on their chest and back with either a percussor or cupped hands to mechanically and physically loosen it up so they can cough it up or we can suck it out. Suctioning, breathing treatments. Some people, like cystic fibrosis patients, have these vests. I don't know if anybody's familiar with these, but it literally is a vest that you put on and it has these ports that you connect these two giant hoses and then you hook it up to a little air compressor and it fills up with air and it literally like jiggles the shit out of you. And it's the same basic concept of like we're literally trying to rattle the mucus clear, rattle it free so you can cough it out. And so pulmonary toileting, literally you can think of it as flushing that, I'm trying real hard not to use gross and cursing language, but you've got to flush all that crud out of your lungs so that you can keep gas exchange and not have it just turn to cement. So long-winded, but am I basically on the right track here?
The only thing I was going to add is that's a fantastic explanation of it, a very important process is coughing and deep breathing and incentive spirometry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's another one, or some people call it the pineapple. There's one, that little breather thing. That
looks like we've also got the aerobica valve.
Yes, it's another
the
one.
Flutter valve, as some call it.
All of which is just designed to help you take deep breaths and eventually make you cough, because that coughing is going to help you expel the mucus and all that crap out of your lungs, open up your airways, open up the lower parts of your lungs, so that way you can help, you know, get rid of that old air, essentially help prevent infection.
Yeah.
Help get that stuff out of there. So I love that. I actually love that word, pulmonary toilet. Like, I wish I had a t-shirt that said pulmonary toilet. I just love that word.
I promote pulmonary toileting. People will be like, is that a political t-shirt?
Right, I'm on the side of pulmonary toileting. I'm going to vote pulmonary toilet this year. I'm just telling you right now, I'm 100% a believer in pulmonary toileting.
So yeah, let's you know, hope that everyone remembers that it, not only do you have to turn your patients to keep them off their red baboon butts, but you also have to shake them up a little bit so that they can cough. And you know, it's good for us too. As nurses, we're running back and forth. How often do you really stop and take a full, deep, chest expansive breath?
Yep.
Probably very not solid. Enough. So I try to do it because I have anxiety, diagnosed generalized anxiety disorder. And that's a lot of, I don't care that there's no stigma about it. I don't feel the need to censor that. But one of the things that I have to do is I have to actively work to calm down my sympathetic nervous system, my fight or flight response. And the way to slow down your heart rate is to slow down your breathing. So there are totally times when I'll be in the med room and I'm racing from patient to patient to patient to patient. And I literally get into the med room and I literally stop for all of maybe 15 seconds, 2-3 breaths. And literally just take a couple breaths. It is scientifically guaranteed to slow your heart rate down. Maybe not your racing mind, but yeah.
Oh, I can totally relate there. And
so yeah,
I think that's a nice segue into some of the questions that we got posed by some of our viewers, which is very
perfect.
Exciting.
Yeah, we got a message.
Tell me about that.
All right, so you guys know that we are all over social media. We have a Facebook page, our Medroom Chronicles Facebook page. Got a message from Tabitha. Hi, Tabitha. Thanks for your message. She just had a few questions that she wanted us to talk about. She said she's really enjoying the show. We're really glad she's enjoying the show. I hope you're sharing. But we wanted to address a few of her questions kind of in rapid fire style. So we're just going to take a few minutes to talk about each one. And, so we'd also like to encourage folks, if you have questions you'd like us to answer, we're not experts on everything, but if it's a question we can't answer, we can either help lead you to resources or, you know, we can just tell you, we don't know.
We don't know. We don't have any freaking clue.
Look it up. Look
right?
it up.
Look it up. Right. Google. Right.
Yeah. So, all right. The first thing that Tabitha wanted us to talk about is she wants us to talk about confidence in nursing, both the lack of and overconfidence. And I know, in all seriousness, I can totally talk about lack of confidence because that's been the biggest thing that I've been trying to work on, you know, in my early days of nursing is, you know, that... And actually, I think Sean Dent just did a video about this not very long ago, which, you know, I encourage everybody to go listen to it. But he talks about the whole fake it till you make it phrase. And I'm not going to go into that discussion. He basically says, like, no, you're not portraying yourself fraudulently, but your patient doesn't know that you're scared. You might be terrified, but you need to not walk in there and do something that you're not trained or equipped to do. But, you know, if it's the first time you've done a tacrolimus blood draw in the morning and you're nervous, you don't need to go in there and be like, oh my God, I've never done this before. I'm really sorry if it hurts and I'm going to try. And no, you walk in there and you say, it's time for me to draw your blood. I'm just going to take a minute to get some things ready. That patient doesn't need to know that. You're trained, you're well equipped to do this. Just because you're nervous doesn't mean they can see that. So he talks a little bit about that. I'm paraphrasing and putting in some of my own ideas, but yes. So Andrew, talk to me a little bit about, what do you want to start with? lack of confidence or overconfidence? Because these are very different.
So when I graduated nursing school, got licensed about 4 months later after graduation, I wanted to take the first job I could get my hands on. So the first job that got offered to me was actually a job I applied for on Craigslist about an hour and a half away.
Oh, yeah. We talked about this in a previous episode, your long-term care job. Yeah,
yep, exactly. And I, for the first 3 weeks of that job, I drove an hour and a half each way every day. Mm. And
did you work back-to-back shifts?
Yeah, it was three 12s. So that was made for a long, long day. Yeah, for a long time, I absolutely hated that job because of a number of reasons. But regarding confidence, at that time period of my nursing career, I was, of course, very new. I had zero healthcare experience aside from volunteering at a local ER and nursing school. I was never a CNA, a med tech, any of that stuff. So I was green as hell, so green. And the other problem was I got 7 days, Adrian, of orientation. And then I was completely on my own from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. in a rural nursing home responsible for 50 nursing home residents, 10 memory care unit, like Alzheimer's patients that were very, very severe dementia, and then an assisted living. I was on my own as a brand new nurse.
That's terrifying.
It is so, it's so terrifying, Adrian. And so I
have some experience now, and I'm like, hell no, I wouldn't do that job.
Oh, absolutely. If I, in retrospect, I mean, I learned so much, but at the same time, it was so dangerous, Adrian. The people there, we can get into more of this, you know, like,
another episode topic.
I should write this down. But yeah, this, I'll just give you like a blip. Like this nursing home was owned and bought recently by a corporate entity that absolutely didn't give a shit about the residents. And I say that confidently because we needed staff to take care of these people and we just didn't get it. They would always disapprove it. They wouldn't approve the staffing. I'll give you an example. We had 2 CNAs for that entire place and 1 CNA for the memory unit and a nurse. 1 brand new nurse. They're willing to put a brand new nurse on the floor after 7 days. It was totally unsafe and I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And so there was a lot of problems. And so when I was put in that role, I had no choice but to assume this relatively overconfident, arrogant, persona. Part of it was I was a brand new nurse. I felt like I needed to change the world. I was very hyped up from nursing school. Like I had all this brand new knowledge. I had this awesome job that actually paid me some money. And now I'm in this really very responsible role all by myself as a new nurse. And I had no choice but to portray overconfidence. The problem with that was my relationships with the staff that I was working with was really shitty because I was very arrogant. I didn't accept help and I offered unsolicited advice when I could find the opportunity to. Now, granted, I'm very, very different than when I was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And in fact, Adrian, one guy, I developed a relationship with a CNA, very experienced, been doing this for like 15 years, knew all kinds of amazing information. He basically took me aside after about four or five months in, and he said, Andrew, you're being an asshole. You're a nice guy, but at work, you're being an asshole. And the only reason he would have known that is because we hung out outside of work. And it was from that point on that, I had no idea. For one thing, I was totally oblivious. And granted, when you're a brand new nurse, you have all this stuff floating around in your mind. You're like, oh my God.
And you're excited.
Excited. Mm-hmm. You don't want to kill anybody. You're just like, oh my God, I don't want to make this mistakes. I got all this documentation standards. I don't want to get sued. I've got these nurse practices. I mean, all this stuff roaming around in your head, plus the patient care. And so all of that was going through my mind as a new nurse with no experience in a role that I probably shouldn't have been in. And he's like, Andrew, you know, you need to change it up. And so I understand that dangerous level of overconfidence, you know, lack of being humble or humility. So
talk a little bit about why that's dangerous. Why is it dangerous to be overconfident in nursing?
I think the bottom line is a person could die from it, because if you don't accept help from your teammates when they notice an issue with humility, it's going to affect patient care or potentially. And that's really it, Adrian. If you aren't approachable, if you're not a team member, if you're overconfident, you know, narcissistic, that type of stuff, people aren't either going to approach you, or when they do, it's going to be a conflict because you don't want to hear what they have to say. And ultimately, the safety of the patient could suffer. And I can speak from personal experience where I was not approachable. And I mean, I have no idea, you know, to this day, you know, where my patients are now. I mean, you know how long-term care is. Hell, you know, half of them might not even be alive now.
Right.
But the point is, patient care can suffer because of that.
So how did you break some of these habits, some of these negative traits? So for those who maybe are feeling like, maybe that's me, that, or for people that are like, yep, that's me. How do people walk that line between being confident and good at what they do and being a-holes, the pariah of the unit? Like, oh boy, here she comes. She's gonna move that pillow that you just placed because you didn't do it right.
I think there has to be a moment, kind of like I was telling you about that guy that said, you know, Andrew, you need to change it up. You're being mean, essentially. How does a person that doesn't know that they're like that get that? Well, it takes a special someone that feels comfortable enough to say, hey, listen, I noticed this. You know, it's a very strange thing to go up to somebody and be like, you know what? You're offending me. You're being mean, hurting my feelings. Sometimes that works. That really works with people. If you say, you know what, I think you're a fantastic person, but the way you act, you're hurting my feelings.
Yeah. Or sometimes that really I'll just say to some. People. Yeah. Or sometimes even if you just say to someone, that's not cool.
That's not cool. Yes.
That's all you have to say. It's not about, you know, you don't have to say like, you're a terrible person, I hate working with you. You don't have to make it a bigger problem. But in that moment, if someone, say, for example, if someone is about to, I gotta hang this medication. I think I might need a filter for, I'm not sure, whatever, it doesn't matter. I tried to find the pit, whatever. I hung on this before, like a long time ago. I remember, you know, like that's when it gets dangerous. And you can say, you know, if it's something that's going to cause harm to someone, I would say something to the effect of, and granted, everybody's different. I'm not telling people exactly what to say word for word. But, you know, I would say something like, I don't doubt that you've done this before, but let me help you find that policy because we don't want it. We want to run a zero risk game here for your patient. You know, like we don't want to go just on instinct. So let me just find that, you know, you go ahead and you get that medication and I'll look up the policy and, you know. So there are soft ways to cushion it. Like I worked with a nurse a long time ago who was going to do a port change and it needs to be sterile. And that nurse, you know, didn't at the time, the kits that we had at this other hospital didn't have the sterile gloves in them. And I said to the nurse, hey, what size sterile gloves do you want? Instead of being like, you're supposed to do that sterile and starting a fight. Well, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. I just said, hey, what size sterile gloves do you need? And that person was like, oh, I have to do this as a sterile procedure. Yeah, we don't want to give them a bloodstream infection. So I'll go grab whatever size you need. What size, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're not being offensive. You look like you're helping them, which you are. And you're helping that patient ultimately. So I think that you know, from your perspective, you're saying like, yeah, it might take that person to be like, dude, knock it off.
Yeah.
And if you're that person who works with someone, you know, definitely try to use tact and do it gently. But also, I'm one of those people that if you work in an institution where you can't say, whoa, 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 no, that's unsafe. Like, I'm not trying to be offensive, but we need to look up that policy now. You can't hang that like that. And if that person doesn't listen, you need to do what you need to do to protect that patient. Now, I'm not saying wrestle the nurse to the ground and take the medication out of their hand, but like...
Right. You can you imagine that? Boy, that'd be interesting.
No, you know, it's like you're ultimately responsible. You know, the choice to do nothing is still a choice. And so I'm not saying that you have to go up to every person on your unit and be like, you're mean and you're overconfident and you need to just learn a little bit instead of bossing everybody. Yep. No, but, you know, try to have the courage in those moments where you see someone being a little hot doggy and say, like, that's not cool, man.
When you approach someone, when you, you know, confront a person's ego like that, it takes a very special moment. It's not something that's like a daily thing.
And,
you have to feel good about doing it because it's hard to say that.
It is. But ultimately, our responsibility is to our patients. And if that isn't enough, well, first of all, if that isn't enough motivation for you, then bye-bye, go get a different job. But don't be at the bedside. But, you know, if you are in a situation where you're dealing with that, you need to... I lost my train of thought because it's like, you know, the middle of the morning. But basically, you need to be able to speak up. Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Sorry. Hello. You need to be able to protect your patient and then ultimately your license. Because even if you don't have empathy for the patients that you're taking care of for whatever reason, you need to ultimately remember that a misstep, negligence, can land your ass in court. And even if you have good insurance, you don't want to be there. You don't want to be in that seat ever. So you can even say that to a person. If someone is just being arrogant and acting like they know everything, you know, try to bring it back to the patient. What are you doing for your patient? And if that's not enough, this is going to get your ass into trouble. As your friend and your coworker, I'm telling you, you probably shouldn't do that. So the level of intensity needs to fit the risk at hand.
So I was thinking on an individual level, say a person realizes that, you know what? Well, okay. When a person is overconfident, oftentimes they don't realize that they're being overconfident. So I guess the real question is, how does a person get to the point where they are starting to realize it? How do they become introspective?
You know, I think that it's hard to teach people how to read body language, but there are some basic things that I've picked up along the way that I think kind of ring true most of the time. Okay, say you're standing with three of your, say you're in clinicals, okay? You're a nursing student. You're in clinicals and you're standing with three of your classmates and you're just, it's kind of some downtime and everybody's okay and the nurses are kind of chilling that happens all the time. But anyway, you're talking to your classmates and they bring up a topic and you are like, oh, I know all about this topic. And you start, you know, talking about it and nobody else is speaking and they're not engaged and you're still talking and people are starting to look around and like read body language. You can tell people don't give a flying F about what you're saying. And then also another rule of thumb, just in conversation in general, even say you're at a party, you're talking to a bunch of people, you get interrupted. If nobody says, hey, oh, I'm sorry, you got interrupted. How does that story end? Or, okay, what happened next? If nobody asks you to pick up where you left off, let it go. They didn't give a shit. And I think that's the truth in a clinical setting as well. I have to watch it because when I get passionate about a topic that I think I know a lot about, my intention is I want to share my knowledge. I want you to know everything that I've learned because I want you to know it too. But what it might sound like is I'm on a monologue about how much I know, and everybody's like, yeah, good for you. I'm not listening to you anyway. So pay attention to body language. If you've been talking for a while and nobody's saying like, uh-huh, or oh yeah, or yeah, oh yeah, I had that happen to me too. Like if nobody's engaged and they're just standing there looking at you, shut up. I've had to learn that the hard way. Yeah. And I repeatedly apologize to my peers from nursing school. And I say, I genuinely was just trying to help, but sometimes I'm sure I came off as a smarty pants. So,
oh God,
you've got to develop introspective abilities while you're in these kind of caretaker roles.
You know, I think another thing that happened in my life that really was at the same time is, aside from the new role as a new nurse, dangerous setting in long-term care, you know, I had a lot of personal issues. You talked about generalized anxiety. I also had a breakdown, anxiety, panic attacks, depression, because they're peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It
seems. And at the same time, I can't remember exactly when I started, but I started to go to counseling that consisted of group therapy, individual counseling, psychiatric visits, meeting with like a counselor / social worker, and then medication. And I think a combination of all of that, and ultimately I found that a lot of my troubles originated from my childhood, as a lot of people do, right? And so it really helped me become more introspective, because I had no choice. I had to confront the demons, essentially, that I had been sitting and bottling up for the last 25 years. And so I don't necessarily think that a person has to go to a psychiatrist and go to group therapy to become introspective. But at the same time, you know, there is some benefit and value to seeking out support. And, you know,
absolutely,
there are debriefing groups. There are, you know, what does the university have for your nurses to help debrief, essentially?
There's a number of things that can be done, and I'm sure there are also things that are done at other institutions that I don't even know about, but let's start out with the big stuff. So if we have an event, like, for example, if you have, say, you have a patient who you know very well that is either a long-term patient or a frequent flyer, however you want to refer to it, and say, you know, over the course of years they're managing this long-term illness and they get to a point where then they die. Well, yeah, you're just that patient's nurse, but maybe you've known this person for 10 years, or for whatever reason, a traumatic code or something that just wasn't handled well, and we're all kind of upset about it. Our leadership will oftentimes recognize this, or even if they don't recognize it and someone goes to them and says, like, hey, as a unit, we're struggling with this. Maybe I'm just lucky. Maybe I'm on a unit that's good about it. But they'll have a debriefing. They'll say, like, you know, we're going to do it at this time. They try to do it at a time. Granted, they can't accommodate everybody, but they try to make it at a time. So we'll do, like, unit-based, where it's just us. We also, if you want to look at more of, like, the hospital-wide level, we have, and actually I learned Doug at a smaller organization caring for the disabled, they also have an employee assistance program where a number of services are offered, but one of those is that you can do like 3 to 5-ish counseling sessions. You don't have to do all three. Say you just need a debrief because you had a rough month or whatever. You're provided this by your employer. Now, some places don't have this because they're small or whatever, but at the very minimum, you know, if you've been on the unit a while and you kind of know who the people are that have been around and have had these experiences, you could go to them and say, hey, I don't want to take up a lot of your time, but I'm having a hard time with this. Can we just talk about it for a minute? Like, do you have a minute? Or, you know, do you have a time in the future that we could talk about it? So I think the debriefing is really important. And I think that there should be some things in place. You should check with HR or check with your leadership.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, you know, those are some ways to handle overconfidence.
Yeah. You know,
I was wondering, you mentioned that you have some experience with lack of confidence. Can you tell me?
Oh, absolutely.
How you've handled that?
Here's the thing. Yeah. And actually, I think maybe my experience is slightly, I don't want to say unique because I don't think it is. I think there are other people in my shoes. But basically, I was a nursing assistant in the hospital where I now work for 11 years. I was in the float pool for 5 years. I worked neurosurgery. I worked cardiac. I went to burn. Basically, as a nursing assistant, there was very little in the hospital I couldn't do. Granted, there were some services I never went to. I didn't go to behavioral health and psych. I didn't go to OR. I didn't go to peds. But in terms of like med surg and that kind of thing, ICU, I've seen a lot. So I was very confident as a CNA. I knew my role. I could run circles around other CNAs. And that's not to be arrogant. I just worked really hard. You know, I also would come home with backaches and tears in my eyes. But basically, I went from a role where I knew exactly what my job was into a role as a nurse where not only did I do it on the same unit that I was working as a CNA, which I'm actually going to write on my little notepad that I got here next to me that I want to talk about role confusion. But I was a CNA on that unit and then became a nurse. So I went from being like one of the most, not, I wasn't like a hot shot or anything, but like I had some of the most experience on the unit at the time and was like training other NAs and, you know, and now I find myself in this nursing role where I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Oh my God. And you know, we all have these moments, whether we're new to nursing, new to the setting we're in, you know, whether we've gone to nursing school and then gone away from nursing, come back, whatever your situation is, you're always going to have situations where you're out of your element, whether it be a diagnosis, an emergency, something that you're just not, there's going to be a time when you're uncomfortable. And so you need to learn, first of all, to kind of getting back to the fake it till you make it. You don't want to pretend that you're something you're not, but don't necessarily. The problem that I had is I would get nervous and I would tell everybody, oh my God, I have to do this. I can't believe I have to do this. Am I going to be able to do this? I don't think I can do this. And people would, you know, because partly I was looking for support from my team, but really what I was doing is I was making myself into a nervous Nelly and everybody was like, is she going to be okay? Are you all right? And yeah. I think that fed my anxiety and my lack of confidence rather than, you know, and I've worked with other nurses too that will be like, will you come check my NS drip? And you're like, it's water. Unless your patient is like, you know, unless they have a major sodium imbalance, you know, unless their sodium's way off, you're probably okay, you know, I mean, that's isotonic. We're okay. But you know what? It's to make sure. But I understand it. I don't want to make fun of that person because, but it is funny because as an experienced nurse, you're like, is it open? Are they breathing? You're
totally
cool.
Relate to this.
But I've done stuff like that too, you know, or like you read an order 15 times because for me, the thing was when I first started, my big thing that I double check and triple check and oh my God, I wasted so much time checking compatibility of medications that I was putting into people's IVs because I was terrified. And I did once in orientation, I crystallized some tubing. Yeah. For those of you that don't know, if you put incompatible medications together in the same IV tubing, you are going to make some horrible, horrible, sharp little jaggedy looking solutes that are not supposed to be in your patient's veins. And luckily, the situation that happened to me, I had a great team around me. Somebody noticed it right away. No harm to the patient. Big lesson learned to me, but I was so terrified that I would check and I wasted a lot of time that way. So here's what I'm going to say to people who don't have confidence. First of all, your patient doesn't know that you're terrified unless you're going in there and you're trembling like a leaf, in which case step out of the room, gather yourself. Don't do that.
Right.
But like if you go, like I said before, they don't know that you haven't drawn this blood draw before. You've been trained, you can do it, just do it. It's like when you're up on stage giving a speech and you feel like you've been silent awkwardly for like 25 minutes and it's been like 4 seconds. Okay. So just calm down a second and remember that they don't know what you don't know.
Yep.
So that's the first thing, is just don't go in there and grovel and make yourself, don't show your cards, okay?
Unless your patient's a nurse or a doctor.
Right. And then, but you know what? In that case, unless that person is a cold-hearted person, if yes. you say to them, like, I'm new, and while I don't know everything, you know, I'm very careful, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, that's different. If you've got a medical professional, that's nerve-wracking, and that's a whole right. different topic.
In itself, even as an experience, right. I'm right. a lot more comfortable with it now.
But the other thing I'll say, the other thing that is going to serve you well if you're someone who doesn't have confidence, like I'm constantly like, oh my God, what's the policy say about this? Am I doing this right? Am I supposed to flush with this or that? So you need to get really, really used to using your resources. Like at the university, for example, on our desktop of every computer, there is a giant letter P. That is the policy manual. And a lot of people are like, I don't know how to use it. I don't know how to, you have to go into this folder. No, mm-mm. I go to the search field and I type in, like the other night, I typed in insulin drip. It took me right to the, you know, everybody's system is a little different. But the point is, learn how to look stuff up, because you don't need to know everything. You will never know everything. But if you know how to look things up, you'll be fine.
Well, a good example, I just want to interject real quick. A good yeah. example of that is exactly what you're describing with the insulin drip. Every place that I've ever been at as a travel nurse has had a different insulin.
Different algorithms. That's right.
And the verbiage is different. The structure is different. The algorithm, the numbers are different. And so I don't even bother knowing the algorithm or the policy. I just know how to find it.
Right.
And that's it. And that's, it's as simple as that.
And most patients are going to appreciate it if you say to them, you know, while I know how to do this, I like to be really organized. Yep. And like, you know, if I have a patient that has a lot of IV meds, I'll print out the compatibility list and I will tape it to the IV pump. If I have my insulin drip going, you know, some people like put it on, tape it on the door or whatever, you know, on the bathroom door or whatever. I want it right by where I'm charting and looking at my orders. So I hang that list up right next to the computer in the room. And that's what I did the other night. And so I can look at that paper, look at that insulin drip order in the EMR without ever having to move where I'm standing. So I have all of my resources. So basically what I'm saying is, know your resources, print out your policies if you need to. And while you don't want to be in a room, you know, with a needle in your hand and a piece of paper in the other going, now slowly slide needle in, bevel up, like you don't want to do that. But if you say yeah. to your patient, you know, I've printed out the policy, I'm going to be referring to it, but this is the best way for me to stay organized and us to stay safe. And you don't apologize for it. You say, this is a tool. This is what we use.
Yep.
And this is what I'm doing. So that I think will help you with confidence. Know your resources, and not only know your resources, like your policy manuals and stuff, but know who your resources are on the unit. As you get to know people, you know, harder when you're traveling or when you're temporary staff. But if it's a unit that you're on, develop those relationships. Figure out who the natural leaders are. Figure out who the people are. You know, like I, for example, I know that there's a particular nurse that I work with that if I have questions about a wound, she is my person. But if I want to ask her about how to bridle in an NG tube, she has no idea.
Yep.
So you just have to learn who knows how to do what, and don't be afraid to ask them for help. But also don't go to them for help 5 seconds before your medication is due. You know, have a game plan. Look far enough ahead that you can be like, oh, I've got to start CVN in 2 hours. I better make sure I know what kind of tubing I'm going to hook up, because if I get busy, I'm not going to have time to look it up later. So those are my tips. Those are my tips for developing confidence. And one last thing I'll say, because I am kind of on a monologue here. People always said to me, it gets better. You learn. It gets better. And I was so frustrated. I was like, I'm going to punch in the nose the next person who tells me it gets better. When? I'm waiting. I would really like it to get better now because this really sucks.
When did it get it better for you?
Yeah, it did. And I'm not here to say like, well, your parents were right. They told you so. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that every day that you work is an opportunity for you to learn how to use a new resource. And if you learn how to use something, teach someone else how to use it, because then you're going to remember it better. I all the time will help people look up policies, because even if we can't find it right away, I'm getting to know things, you know? So those are my tips for developing confidence. And if you're really having a hard time, talk to your doctor. I don't promote that people just go and get on meds for stuff, but if you're anxious or you're having issues with like keeping it together at work, talk to your doctor. Because there are some things that they can do. Even things like cognitive behavioral therapy. Look this stuff up online. Right. There are so many resources. People like you and I, you know, that have, there's a million nurses out there that will tell you more than I even know. So there, that's my monologue on how to develop confidence. You know, sorry, that was long.
I was just gonna add, you know, all of that is fantastic advice, you know, regarding unit leadership as a travel nurse. I basically don't know a soul. I go into these places all the time, and I get floated a lot. For instance, I've been floated at this particular hospital 10 different units. I've kept a list.
Jeez,
in the last 5 months, 6 months.
Yowza.
And that's just the life of the travel nurse. And so,
yeah, adaptability is a really great trait.
Right. And I'd have to say that, you know, before I started travel nursing, I was very comfortable in my specialty, pulmonary step down. I just want to say that the lack of confidence and maybe some of the fear that you have is totally normal. So the only things I would say is, first of all, uncomfortability is healthy. It helps you grow, helps you get confidence, mm-hmm. helps you experience and clinical intuition.
There are no waves in stagnant water. That's right.
There isn't.
Basically, if you're outside your comfort zone, it means that you're doing something you haven't done before, and that ultimately is going to make you better, smarter, more experienced, whatever.
For sure. That I have no idea where the hell I was going to go with
that. I'm sorry.
Next point. It's totally fine. I guess, you know, even though it's at the, you know, it's I had sleep because I had about 6 hours of sleep, 5 hours of sleep. And I woke up this morning. I think I'm in that third shift haze. You know, this is kind of my nighttime, even though I've had sleep.
And, totally. And let's, you know.
I was going to say. I'm
sorry. Yeah. Go.
You know, don't allow that fear and uncomfortability to paralyze you into doing nothing. And that's, I think, why a lot of people don't grow, is because they allow that to rule their life and to prevent them from gaining new experiences, and not just in nursing, but in just life in general. So I just want to encourage you to essentially allow yourself to experience unfamiliar territory.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there. What were you going to say?
No, you didn't. I think I interrupted you, which is what threw you off your train of thought.
Gotcha.
Well, there's one more question that we got from Tabitha. Hold on. Let me go back. What was it? I'm trying to remember what it was off the top of my head, but it's now 7 a.m. Well, sorry, guys, but I'm doing it to you again. It's time for another cliffhanger. I know we took a couple weeks off there. Or was it a week? I don't know. It was a couple crazy weeks for me. And since we're a DIY operation, I just need a little bit more time, so chew on this episode. Come back for part two when we finish answering Tabitha's questions. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, go to medroomchronicles.com and listen to all of our old episodes. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, Google Play, iHeartMusic, YouTube, really anywhere that you can think to look for us. So go find us, listen to some old episodes, and if you're all caught up, sorry guys, just gotta wait till next week. In the meantime, happy nursing, folks.